Today I'm just going to give sort of an overview talk of the Advanced Compton Telescope, and this is a NASA vision mission, and we finished a concept study at the beginning of last year, and so I'm just going to go over some of the science goals and the instrumentation, and then wrap up with an overview of our balloon project at Berkeley, which is basically testing some of these developments on a balloon payload. And I know that Trixie Wunder was here a couple weeks ago, probably primed you guys quite a bit on this science, but and what our goals are. But it's different. I usually give this talk like a salesman. I'm trying to sell this mission, and that is not my goal here at all. I want to get feedback from you guys on what is really interesting and what our real scientific goals can be, because and should be. And I'll go into that actually more on the next slide. So for background, the Advanced Compton Telescope is a mission. It's not in NASA's roadmap, but it's on the roadmap for the roadmap, I guess you would say, of future missions. It was given this goal to uncover how supernova and other stellar explosions work to create the elements, which is NASA lingo for just meaning that we're going to study the gamma ray line emission from, this is being recorded, I should watch myself, being too facetious, of the elements produced in the supernova explosion. So, but my real sense, my real question here for you guys is how sensitive do we need to be? And this is the these are the questions I'll come back to by the end. So hopefully you guys will stay awake during all the talk of the instrumentation, so we can come back and discuss these more at the end. So right now, Advanced Compton Telescope is, as most of you know, NASA is pushing back missions further and further. And I have no idea where ACT would be at this point, but it's probably beyond 2025. So the question is, do we want to wait that long to get this thing going? So my hope is that, you know, after the next election, all these things will be pushed back forward. But originally, we were sort of in the 2015 to 2017 time frame, and it's been moved back. So the good thing about it is we're kind of off the radar now. They're debating all the Beyond Einstein missions, so we're not even on that radar screen at this point, which I'm figuring is actually a good thing in the end. So so my question for you guys, you'll see what our goals are as we go along, but my question is, what sensitivity actually is interesting for these nuclear line, studies? Because you'll see the goals for the Advanced Compton Telescope are extremely ambitious, and we could actually conceive of doing a smaller mission on an Explorer class mission on a shorter time scale, and actually doing some of the supernova science, but my question is, what is interesting enough to do? So what's an interesting sensitivity threshold? For example, would it be good enough to get a 10% measurement of mass in, say, 5 to 10 supernova 1As? Is that an interesting enough science goal to go for? What we're doing now is much more sensitive than this. I mean, the goal's for ACT, so the question is, where can we draw the line for the near-term type developments? ACT is a very wide field of view. It's designed to be able to study the supernova lines completely independently of the optical observations, to discover them and to follow them. That's not necessarily a requirement. If we wanted to couple to a smaller field of view, we could get higher sensitivity for a smaller instrument, and we would just be coupled to optical observations as triggers for the supernova. So some ideas that I want to bat around while we're here, so while I'm here. I'll come back to this later in the talk. We are, I don't know what the distance uncertainty is to 20 megaparsecs, and I've talked to a number of astronomers about this, and we assumed in our study that it was about 10%. Which some people say is very high. So I'll come back to this, how this affects our sensitivity requirements later on in the talk. But it makes a huge difference if this is 10% or a few percent. So in terms of how well we can discriminate different models of supernova. So here's some questions I'm working on this week. Is measuring the mass M56 interesting on its own? Because our goals for ACT are actually much more elaborate than that. It's not just measuring the mass, it's doing spectroscopy and trying to really resolve what we thought would be the hardest models to resolve. And I know you guys would probably have very strong opinions on that. So what I want to figure out is what is our uncertainty of the mass that could be achieved on a small mission. So this is my little mini one-week sabbatical to figure out some of these things. I want to put together a catalog of all the supernova that were formed in maybe a two-year type scenario, just to get an idea of what we could conceivably see in a two-year period, a realistic, you know, set of light curves and such to study what a small mission might look like. And I want to try to figure out this distance uncertainties out to Virgo, which I don't have a very good feel for at this point. So these are the questions I want to come back to the end, and I want to bug you guys this week, so be on the lookout if I'm coming to your door. Go to questions. Okay, so let me start off with ACT and just give an overview. So Advanced Compton Telescope, its goal is to enable high sensitivity gamma ray spectroscopy. This has been a goal for gamma ray astronomy for many, many decades, and I want to try to convince you that at least we know the right direction to take. So for getting this. So we're talking about achieving about 100 times sensitivity, primarily for spectroscopy in the 0.2 to 10 MeV band. So very highly concentrated on the gamma ray nuclear line band, and that's because our primary science goal is the type 1A supernovas, specifically at 847 keV. It's very wide field of view. It sees 25% of the sky at any time. And our baseline for this is a zenith pointing survey mode, so sort of like GLAST, if you're familiar with GLAST at all. You know, it's pointed at the zenith, and it basically sweeps out 80% of the sky on every orbit. So the idea would be we'd be continuously monitoring the whole sky for the gamma ray mission and be able to study, hopefully, many supernova at the same time. Okay, so I don't know if I need to justify this to this group, but the question is, why do we want to do science in the 0.2 to 10 MeV range? There are a number of other science goals, but the primary one that's driving ACT are the nuclear lines, and specifically the type 1A nuclear lines. And so you'll see that even though we have, this is a type of improvements we're proposing to do over CompTel in terms of the number of sources we could achieve over a five-year mission. And so so part of the science goal of ACT is to try to take this field of MeV gamma rays from being a one-off study of every source where each one is unique to being able to do some real survey science on different type of sources. But in the end, all this is just a side result of we want to study the 1As. And so if we can achieve the sensitivity to study 1As, then we can do a lot of other science with this instrument. But yep. So this is so ACT has a couple requirements that are driving it. One is that we get this very high sensitivity in order to study supernova out to 80 megaparsecs or so, something like that. And the other one is that we have a very wide field of view in order to survey this over the whole sky, because we want to be able to pick out supernovas that aren't identified by optical searches. And so the fact we have a very wide field of view means we have a very large background. And so if we had a smaller field of view and we were focusing down on just nearby supernova that were that we could recognize from the optical and we weren't trying to survey the whole sky, then we could get a lot more sensitivity but not do this all sky survey, just focus on specific, you know, we look at this supernova for 3 months and this supernova for 3 months. So that would be the main difference, would be taking away this whole very wide field of view requirement and focusing it down into saying, okay, we really are going to focus on the 1As and do them basically one at a time. So, does that make sense? Okay, so just a refresher, this is the nuclear line chain we're looking at. So the nickel 56, 8-day decay to cobalt 56, 111-day decay. The brightest line here is the 847 line, that the one we're primarily going for, and that's in the MeV band. So just a refresher on some rough numbers that many of you probably know off the top of your head. So in terms of the gamma ray lines, these become optically thin at around 100 days, somewhere between 80 to 100 days, depending on the models. Some, I think, are even as early as 60 days. But the peak line is 847, which is our primary goal. But there are, of course, many other lines that are popping up in these. The peak flux is about 2 to 5, depending on the model, times 10 to the minus 5. Gamma rays per centimeter squared per second, that's at 10 megaparsecs. So just to get some rough numbers that we're shooting for here. Yes, or both. A lot of centimeters and a lot of seconds. So, exactly. So not, yeah, not so bright. We're talking about spectral resolutions about 3%. So, the width of the lines are about 3%. So this comes in when we're calculating sensitivity for these lines. The cobalt lines, the nickel lines, that's what we're guessing. That's what the models show. No, narrow is
narrow.
Narrow is better for us. So.
Okay, so velocities are down,
shouldn't you? Great. Okay, so I'm making notes. Keep talking.
Nobody would think, well, it would be surprising.
What thing? What? So, what size do you think?
Well, I would maybe just.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think? You have 3,000? Something like that.
5,000? Yeah.
And we see that this is not just guessing either. This is what you see. It is the blind world.
Yeah.
Most of the arrows are
too. Okay.
So there's
that. That's great. That's excellent. Yeah, it helps. So, I mean, the issue is the broader the line is, the more background we have underneath it. So the narrower the lines are, it makes it easier for us to see them. So the narrower, the better. So this is the rate that I've sort of been seeing around the literature. So I'm hoping to get some feedback on this rate here, that the local rate is about 1 per 20 megaparsecs per year. And we would love if this point was true, which is the Wood-Vasey point. It actually was, I think, a little bit higher in the thesis, but I'm assuming it's not true, that it's really down somewhere around here in the local universe. That's the supernova factory right result, which was a very high local density. So, and I actually haven't kept up with the debates on that, but. This is the actual measured rates that Peter Milne put together for us over from 1995 to 2005, and so that corresponds roughly to that number for at least the nearby supernova that we are sensitive to.
So, uh-huh. 25 to 50 per year.
So this is if we are sensitive at this range, 1 times 10 to the minus 6, then we would be able to detect around 25 to 50 detections per year. So
go further.
That's right. Further. That's right. Yeah, we would be out here, really out to, somewhere out here, around the 80 to 100 megaparsec range. So.
Be a little careful. I mean, things aren't uniformly distributed.
There's
a gap, and then there's...
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you can see that rolling off here already in the measured distribution. So, but I'm not an optical observer, so I don't know how much of this is observation effect and how much is the distribution effect. And so, but there is... The nearby universe is not homogeneous, right? It's clumpy. Okay, so this is just a compilation of a bunch of different models that Peter Milne put together for what the gamma rays coming out would look like, and this was specifically, of course, for the W7 model. But so these are the type of spectra that we're looking for, and specifically you can see here the nickel 56 lines popping up early with their 8.8 day decay time, and then transitioning to the brighter cobalt 56 lines at later times. Okay, so there's two ways that we can potentially study these. One is through just the light curves and how the emission varies as time. And this is just a compilation of a number of different models and comparisons with, this is supernova 1998 BEU, and this is actually Comptel observation, which is an upper limit, and this is an OSSI observation from GRO. And you can see, I think that this is one of the closest ones they came to actually being able to measure something. This one was at 11 megaparsecs and not your one a year one. So just for comparison, ACTU, which we're proposing, is down in this range. It's actually a little bit higher than that. But you can see we really could do, if we had something like this, we would nail it really easily. So. Okay, so there's the light curve and the spectra. And so this is the spectra of three different models, DD202C, just the late detonation, W7, and then the sub-Chandrasekhar model. And the importance for us here is that how we distinguish models from each other depends a lot on how far the distance is to the supernova. So that's why I was asking this question. So you can see if we know the distance very well, then the light curves themselves are a very strong discriminator of the models. If there's a 10% uncertainty in our distance, then suddenly you can renormalize any of these curves by 10%, and there's not a very strong distinction, at least for unless you get really high sensitivity, between the light curves, and then you're primarily relying on the spectroscopy in order to distinguish the models. So,
My question, why shouldn't the sub-Chandrasekhar, which generates less nickel 56, be dimmer than the, say, the detonation? I don't, I guess.
It's a hard question.
It's a hard question. It's a hard
question.
It's a hard question. It produces as much nickel as the others.
It's also on the outside, so there may be transparency.
So right. Here, if you trigger detonation in the sub-chandra, you incinerate almost all the carbon oxygen into nickel. And so even if you have only half a solar mass of 0.8 or so in your carbon oxygen core, you incinerate more than into nickel.
And these times are even well before these ones are becoming optically thin. So this is popping up at very early times, I think.
From a very learned paper on the distance to 1998 BU.
Uh-huh.
The point is that if you have a type 1A supernova, you have the best distance indicator.
From the light curve.
Yeah.
Right.
So if you have other objects in that galaxy like that, or if you have other galaxies that are like that one for which you know it's going, you have the potential of getting the distance much more precise.
From there.
We should probably discuss that.
Yeah.
Saying 10%, I think, is, especially since the only galaxies you will look at will be ones that have had a nice, bright type 1A zipper.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I think you will be in a stronger position to know the distance of those galaxies than on average.
So what distance, what limits could you put on that one? 90 and
W?
7%.
It could come down to 3 without any special.
See, if we get, that's great. I mean, if we get down to 3%, right, we could really rely on the light curves much more. Absolutely, yeah, that's right. So, because part of the point is to try to, compare the two. But, we got to do what we can do. Right, so.
Well, I think you should put in your pocket the fact that you will have a bright type 1A supernova in that galaxy.
Is 98 BU a normal 1A?
More or less.
Or you don't understand. Yeah.
Which in fact they are.
They are furry bands. So in fact, I think that they are, I forget, but I think these are actually 2 sigma upper limits. And so they're really, yeah. So I would take that all with a grain of salt. So I think the point of that was to show, wow, we were really close. Could have gone either way, probably. Measuring those.
But the other thing you could show is that those lines were seen for 87A.
Yes, absolutely. So,
you know, yeah. It's not as if there's something fundamentally wrong with the nuclear.
Right. Well, but yeah. Very different system, right? So.
Well, but it's iron.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, people saw it. And they saw the ratio of the lines. And
yeah.
Made enough to go back. To
yeah.
Line.
Okay. Okay, so this is the this is sort of the jumping into our motivation for ACT. We've got on paper at least 3 primary goals for the study of the nickel 56 and the cobalt 56. And of course, the one that sells here is this one, of course, to characterize the nickel 56 production relation to the optical light curve. And so this is the circular reasoning question, of course, but depending on what you take as your prior, you're studying different things, right? One is the next one is to use the gamma rays to try to distinguish the explosion physics that's going on in the core. And then the last, of course, is to get an independent rate of the local supernova 1 explosions just from the gamma ray observations themselves. And so if this is what's really pushing the wide field of view and the overall numbers that we have to get in order to do this type of relationship. So if we were doing just the explosion physics one itself, then we would go to a narrow field of view and couple down very, very closely with the optical observers on this. Okay, so our requirements we put on ACT going into our concept study were much more stringent than just measuring the nickel 56. So our goal was to be able to strongly distinguish what we called a typical deflagration model from delayed detonation model. And we saw these as being the two that would be most difficult for us to distinguish. I mean, we went through many, many models. This is primarily Peter Milne who did this for us. And went through the light curves and spectra and picked out the models that he thought would be the most challenging for us to distinguish from each other. And that was our goal, was to be able to distinguish those two. And so we...
Most challenging? Interesting to do or hardest for you to do?
Well, so we picked hardest for us to do. Hardest for us to do. So this was... So he ended up coming up with W7 and DD202C, the delayed detonation model. And the point was that if you rescale them by a distance uncertainty, their light curves actually match very close to each other. So they are hard to distinguish just from the light curve, unless you have a very good distance measurement. And then if you just look at the spectra rescaled to each other, they are close enough, at least for these spherical models, that that they were also very challenging to separate from each other. So this is a really major step to go from not having measured any nuclear lines from type 1A, with the possible exception of 1991T, which is a bit controversial, to being able to go to the point of saying that we're going to actually distinguish the models from each other. So this is a type of sensitivity on ACT from the start. So to reach a broad line sensitivity of less than 10 to the minus 6, we wanted to have a relatively good spectral resolution, less than 1%, in order to actually study the spectroscopy of the lines and the very wide field of view to be able to survey the whole sky at the time. And so this is the type of numbers we were expecting to get out of this going into it. So 40 to 50 detections a year with 5 at 50 sigma. So these would be ones that we could really do the spectroscopy on, not just the detection of light curves. Okay, so this is just a comparison of what's been done previously and where this would put us. So the goal is to get the ACT broadline sensitivity down to this range. And the point was to be getting supernova pushing out towards the Virgo cluster. So that's one at 80 megaparsecs. So we wouldn't be quite going out that far, but we'd be going out far enough that we could actually start doing a real survey. This band, 847, is the one that's really driving our sensitivity requirements. And part of the goal of this is just to show what other types of nuclear science we would be enabling by doing this, so really studying some of the lines we've seen in global galactic distributions, but on a source-by-source scale, really for the first time. So this is our broadline sensitivity, and if we had a, like I said, we're more sensitive for narrow lines, and so that puts us down in this narrow line sensitivity for 10 to 6 seconds, or this for a 5-year mission. So compared to CompTel, which is up here, and Integral, which is up here. So you can see there's it's really challenging jump in sensitivity that we're trying to achieve in this instrument. Okay, so this is just a cartoon, completely a cartoon, which just says if the nickel 56 production is related to the optical light curve, then let's assume that there's a linear relationship and just show for complete propaganda purposes how we could potentially characterize that relationship. So this is just a plot of these models in the nickel 56 mass that we would measure with ACT compared to the optical shift, assuming that there's a linear relationship between those, which, you know, is probably not true at all, but it just gives us something to plot. So against the overall luminosity? Yeah, that's probably a good thing to do as well.
I mean, that's what it is. That's all it does.
Uh-huh.
So the physical thing is that the luminosity
is proportional to the decay rate.
So when you're plotting against something that is the luminosity, which does cover the range, factor 3.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And then there, that's a good point. So, right, and so, that's right. And then there's a relation, and then this is a completely separate relationship. Right, yeah, that's right. That's a good point. I like that. I'm gonna take notes.
Yeah, but that width is probably full width at zero intensity.
Huh?
That width, full width at zero intensity, the one we were talking about before, 10,000.
People with, what do you mean at zero intensity? That was just a real, I think, ballpark number for, you know, we had to pick a challenging resolution to get. Okay. So in terms of the lines, this is a comparison of the spectroscopy we would do for, so this is for a source at 25 megaparsecs, and this is about 25 days in. So this is early in the light curve where it was still low. The point here was to show a comparison of this overlap between the 847 line and the 812 line early on, and how we could do in terms of distinguishing these two models. So these are the two, this is DD 202C. So this is the two models that we picked as being are sort of most challenging to distinguish from each other. And so,
We discussed that during Dixie's talk.
Yeah, I know, so.
And modern would be, this difference would be much smaller.
Yeah, I'd like to find out more about that, so.
Late detonation doesn't happen in an outer shell, mm-hmm. and go add something on top of it, but it happens in some unburned fingers that are right in the middle of all the rest of nickel.
Right.
So the main effect is just to smooth out a bit chemical homogeneity in the velocity space, but that's it.
Okay.
Otherwise, there would be such a big difference.
So is that changed the overall light curves as well, or is it?
You produce somewhat more nickel.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes things a bit tighter. But what you see in the lines more or less, mm-hmm. in this case, it's just a layering of this nickel being different in the delayed detonation mode as compared to pure different. bearing is not given on this way in the modification.
Okay.
Okay.
Have you done the light curves for and the spectroscopy for those?
Light curves and spectra already for some of the models. Actually, in one of the integrated proceedings 2 years ago, I've given them. They've been done by people in Spain, but never really published other than in this proceeding. We are definitely doing it again.
But not unless you did the late detonation submitted matches, light curves and spectra. So
no, we've done it because the detonation, new detonation, light curve and spectra are also mostly in one case. And so just looking now at the distribution of nickel in the new multi-D deflectation and then delay detonation type of models, it appears to have guess, it's speculation, let's say an educated guess.
Mm-hmm.
Just from the way now the nickel is distributed, I would not expect that the gamma ray light curves and then spectra look so different from a pure deflectation.
Okay. Well, maybe I can get the references from you on that. Yeah, that'd be good. Okay, and then the last which I wasn't going to talk about too much, is this possibility of measuring not just a local supernova rate, but
cosmological
supernova. And there's been predictions for a long time that around the AV range, that the primary background would be the cumulative effect of supernova out to higher Z, where they're building up these lines, and you see the redshifted lines. These more recent calculations by Zhang and Beacom are showing, predict this actually to be down lower than where people have predicted it before, which was more up here. And so I'm not quite as optimistic that we would be able to measure that directly, just because it's sitting on top of our background here. But they actually showed in this paper that you could do the angular correlations for these fluxes and be able to pull some of this out. So I think it's a neat trick, but whether we do it or not, we have to study in I think a lot more detail. So. Okay, so Compton telescopes then and now. This is where I'm switching over a little bit into the instrument side, and then I'm hoping we can come back and talk about some of these science issues towards the end. Advanced Compton telescope, by its name, it's a Compton telescope. So let me give you a little bit of history on that and the perspective we're coming from. There have been two Compton telescopes that have flown in space. There's CompTel on GRO, and then there's EBIS on Integral, which has not had a lot of results out for its Compton mode. But our primary model for building a telescope in this energy range comes from CompTel, and the idea is very similar, but it's been updated quite a bit. And the basic idea is that our primary photon interaction in the MEV range is Compton scattering. And so instead of trying to get around that fact through pretending it's lower energy for coated mass or trying to do pair tracking or anything like that, we just take advantage of the Compton scattering itself and try to use that to build a telescope. And so the idea is that a photon comes in, it scatters at some point in the detector, where we can measure the position, the energy, and then it scatters off, and we pick up the scattered photon at another location where we measure its position, the energy. By knowing the positions and energies, we can reconstruct this scatter angle at this point using the Compton scatter formula. And that allows us to project this initial photon coming in back onto the sky. So the problem is it doesn't project it to a point, but it projects it to a circle on the sky. So our images are overlaps of all these circles. So, but its real advantage is that it is a crappy imaging technique, but it is an imaging technique. So it allows us to take our background, which normally would be field of view, and narrowed it down to the solid angle of those rings, typical solid angle. So it does provide a really major improvement in sensitivity from that. And then our processing requires to take those circles and turn them back to images for imaging or just a newly defined field of view for spectroscopy. GRO, just for some numbers, CompTel had about 40 cubic centimeters resolution. It had about 10% energy resolution at about 0.1% efficiency. So 1 in 1,000 photons that came in the telescope was actually successfully detected by CompTel. And since CompTel was conceived in the 70s, we've had over 30 years of gamma ray detector technologies to improve on this basic model. And but you can see that we had a lot of room for improvement. So first off, the big factor we had to work here with efficiency. And so with modern techniques, we can get that up by two orders of magnitude efficiency. So I should say that CompTel was already a big instrument. Okay? So it's pretty clear going into this type of study that we're not going to make an instrument that is significantly bigger than CompTel. So we'd have to make an instrument that is better than CompTel. And so one way to do that is to really work on this efficiency number. Of course, for nuclear lines, getting this energy resolution down helps. And primarily where you work on the efficiency through this number, though, which was the resolution. So the idea is when you want to find the scattering between these points, the separation between these planes for CompTel was really driven by that position resolution. So you're trying to get a lever arm between point A and point B. How well you can define that depends on how big your uncertainty is on those two points. And so by pushing our position resolution down, and most modern detectors we can get down to about a millimeter cubed position resolution, we no longer have this model of scattering between one detector plane to another. Our real model for modern CompTel telescope is just to try to have, this came out really bad, but just to try to have as uniform a detector volume as possible. And here we're not worried about scattering between one layer to another. We just want to track the scattering as it goes through the instrument and be able to resolve the position and the energy of each interaction. So we don't care if it comes down and scatters and backscatters in the instrument or scatters sideways or what. As long as we can reconstruct the position and the energy of each interaction, we can reconfine it to get the compton circle back out. And so from going to this very sort of, I would say, low density type configuration where you can get photons that scatter out very easily, just to this very compact configuration, we can get the improvement in sensitivity by factors of 100 out pretty easily. And so that's our big first step towards being able to improve the sensitivity on these. Another big step, which I won't go into too much detail on, is the fact that if we can measure the positions and the energies of these interactions, we can get rid of a lot of our backgrounds. So in this energy band, you put instruments up and they become radioactive, which is what you're trying to measure. So we kind of have a real trouble with backgrounds in this energy band. But the primary background interactions in the instrument are beta decays. Beta decays have very different signature in terms of fast electron produced and then coincident gamma rays that come out. Those gamma rays are specific energies for the material. And so we can recognize those now and reject most of them. So there's also a big improvement going to this high spectral resolution in getting rid of internal backgrounds in the instrument. And so, how do we build ACT? Well, the problem is we got too many options right now. We've had 3 decades of detector development, and the number of detectors that can achieve this type of resolution, both spatially and spectrally, is probably in the on the order of 10 different detector types that can do that. So our biggest challenge in defining an instrument is trying to figure out what is a configuration that is most sensitive. And these are probably about half of the different detector types that we were studying for our concept study. So one of our goals for the ACT concept study was to come out with very specific technology recommendations on what an optimal instrument would look like. The primary trade-off here, which I won't go into detail, are a little bit more detail later, but not a lot, are stopping power. For example, silicon is cheap, easy to make in large numbers, but it doesn't have very high stopping power. And so so there's a trade-off there in terms of more material you put, the more channels you get, more power, mass, you know, very mundane things that us experimentalists love to worry about, mass and power, that defines a whole mission. Germanium, which is what I work on, has very high spectral resolution, so the highest spectral resolution for gamma ray instruments, but it has to be cooled down to liquid nitrogen temperatures, so it's a kind of a challenge. There's things like CZT, which work at room temperature nominally, so that's good, but they have relatively poor spectral resolution, so it's not only bad for the science, necessarily bad for the science of resolving the lines, but the whole Compton process of being able to resolve the positions of the energies relies on how well you can resolve the energies as well. And so there are trade-offs between all these detector technologies. Putting our collective noggins together for the ACT team, we came up with this sort of baseline design for the concept study. So our design, our goal was to come up with a baseline design that a priori a number of us felt would be probably a good candidate for the most sensitive, and then compare other instrument designs to this one. So I'll explain that more in a second. But our baseline design here was basically it's a little bit over a meter on side. It's got a low Z silicon layers on top for and higher Z germanium things in the back. And both of these are detector technologies that have pretty good spectral resolution, so less than a percent. And the putting silicon on top of germanium were actually they were threefold. One was politics, because we had to get them in there to make everybody happy on the collaboration. The second was actually a little bit more honest in the sense that the low Z silicon lets the photons get in, and then if it hits the higher material, then it has a backscattering of less energy, so it's less probable to get out. So there is some that this actually helps us in the efficiency, and that does show in the simulations. And the other one is a trade-off between silicon. It's more of a mission trade-off. The silicon has many more channels. There's many more layers, and so the limiting factor for the silicon in the end will be how much power is produced, but that's power in terms of the number of electronics channels. The germanium, which is sitting down here below, has to be cooled, cryogenically cooled, so that's a different challenge for the system, which also comes back to being primarily a power challenge. And so the point of coming up with this design was to come up with a mission envelope. So from using the baseline design, we come up with a mass limit, which is based on this, a power limit, and a size limit for the science instrument. And then we could go back to the collaboration and say, okay, now we want to actually compare apples and
oranges
within the same basket. So you can come up with whatever instrument you design you want, make it your most sensitive for your detector technology, but it has to fit within this envelope so that we can really compare missions to missions. So the problem is with so many different detector types we're looking at, you know, some of them have advantages in terms of tracking electrons, some in spectral resolution, and everybody thinks theirs is the best. And so we had to find an honest way to compare the different types together to get a serious comparison between them. So this is our mission configuration. Like I said, it's a zenith pointer. So this is, as it circles around the Earth, it's continuously sweeping out its field of view. And so this by itself has about a quarter of field of view of the sky that it's looking at any time. And as it sweeps out, it covers about 80% of the orbit. This was, the color didn't come out of this. This is the performance of the baseline instrument that we simulated. And the important point is mostly this one. So our baseline instruments didn't quite achieve our goal going in of 7 times 10 to the minus 7, but it got pretty close enough we think that we're in the right ballpark for getting this down. And this is still, you know, factors of 30 or so more sensitive than 50 times more sensitive than CompTel. So I think we're in the right mode for this. But it's this, the narrow line sensitivity and the field of view, 25% of the sky, so that we continuously cover many supernova at the same time, that is completely dominating our mission design for ACT. So, see, this is just a little bit of the trade-off between the detector types, like I was saying. We've got ones that have very high spectral resolution, germanium and silicon. Almost all of them have this fine spatial resolution for tracking the photons. For positioning the interactions. There's a question, if you could actually track the recoil electron, you'd be able to narrow these Compton cones down to an arc. And so there's a couple of instrument types that have proposed to do that. So the main problem we see with those is that in order to track the electrons, your efficiency goes to crap. And so overall, your sensitivity drops very quickly. So right now, we don't see that as being a real requirement. Fast timing, if you have the chance to track the electron interactions, it's a little bit easier. I mean, the photon interactions, it's a little easier to order them, but it's not a requirement. Room temperature, so you can see the trade-offs here a little bit more. I'm happy to go in these in as excruciating detail as you might like offline, but I'm mostly just trying to build up to our final curves on the sensitivity. So a number of different types of instruments are studied in that same envelope that I had mentioned in terms of mass and power. And this is the point I was trying to build to, which is our discrimination of what instrument types are good candidates. Okay, so what this is a plot of, for different instrument types configured in here, it's a plot of what their sensitivity is versus their energy resolution. And so this is coming back to the science goals. And so for each one, for example, for our baseline here, we're getting down to a little bit above 10 to the minus 6, so 10 times 10 to the minus 7, for an energy resolution that is on this order, much less than 1%. There's two curves here. So these curves are how well that instrument would distinguish these two supernova models, so the W7 and the DD202, at 20 megaparsecs. So this is the one here. So these are if we knew the distance perfectly to them. So this is primarily driven by the light curves for these curves. So these are the dot dash curves here. And you can see that for the baseline, we're getting into the sort of 10 sigma discrimination between these models if we know the distance very well. Okay, so this is, I think, very powerful. These curves are if we don't know the distance better than 10%. Okay, and you can see that what was 9 sigma now drops down to 4 sigma. And you can see these also depend on the energy resolution. That's because if the distance uncertainty goes to 10%, then we're relying much more on the spectroscopy to tell them apart than the absolute luminosity. And so we do better with better spectral resolution, if that makes sense. And so so this is what's really driving this question of what is the real distance uncertainty of 20 megaparsecs, and that's why I want to get some good feedback on that. So.
And by 2025, they're going to have even...
Oh, absolutely. That's great.
...the endpoint slightly differently. Yeah, surely, so questions we'll be asking, that you'll be asking by the time you launch this, have nothing to do with 10 and 20-year-old models.
Yep.
How you do this in your concept study, I don't know, but
right.
This is what any instrument has to wrestle with.
That's right. That's right.
Drastically different.
Well, so what we were, our approach here was to take what we thought were current models at the time. Remember, we were doing this in 2003, 2002 when we started this, and so, and say, given those, what are we trying to prove here? And by the way, we were shooting for 2015, not 2025. We came for this, so.
Just you asked
right.
A much simpler question.
That's what I want to hear.
Why? Is it an exploding single white dwarf, or is it a merger of two white dwarfs?
Uh-huh.
And what would be the signature of that in the gamma ray line? That is actually a question that is of tremendous interest. Mm-hmm. It's still an open question, and we'd all like to know the answer. And if you could tell us mm-hmm. by doing the gamma ray lines, that would be good,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean,
yeah, it's
but I, uh-huh. putting it in this language, I think, is a big mistake,
uh-huh.
because the difference between those models is like the difference between similar models for the same situation.
Right, right, right.
And, you know,
right.
that's all going to change at the,
right.
at the small level.
I think in the next couple of years we will provide clear predictions for the most CC values
emerging. Yeah, maybe, but that's...
Yeah. And then, well, even if it's 2015,
but yeah, they will definitely be but you can still pump this up into the right question because the optical
well, so this is exactly right.
Infrared observations and all sorts of things right. resolve a lot of these issues
mm-hmm.
before you get to
uh-huh.
I don't want to be pessimistic about it, but it's not like we're going to just sit and wait to do it.
No, absolutely. So this is why I'm asking the question here. What do you guys feel is the right question to ask? And is there, I mean, when I think about it, I think about it in terms of mass limits. So we can put a mass limit on it, on the M56, and we have the potential of doing spectroscopy on it as well to put a velocity. So now I know, of course, we are very aware that people are doing this in optical, and they're not sitting around waiting for us. So my question to you guys, which I want to know, is there an easier question we can ask than this? Because this is very abstract, I agree, and these things are going to change. This is what was driving our 7 × 10⁻⁷ requirement to start with.
By this time, there will be something happening at the all-spec survey level in the optical
mm-hmm.
by this time. Maybe all of this.
So, yeah.
So your initial question of why not go to narrow field view, to me, seems to be the way to go rather than all the time. You're not going to inform the rate question, that would be.
And the question of how many we're missing inside the Virgo. I don't really know the answer to that, but not zero, but not a lot.
Right.
Not a lot.
Right.
And with a 100-day warning, I don't see why this patrolling the whole sky concept is
yep.
really the right thing.
Yep.
But how do you know it's not a lot?
Well,
I would guess the same, but we really know this.
Oh, but we know where most of them are.
The part that's heavy is
very fair. The Dumas catalog, but not anyway, maybe we should talk about it. Oh, we have the Dumas catalog for
that. Right. Remember, the heavily tiered regions are not most of the
well, there could be a potential circular argument there, right?
So.
Oh, right. You're right. Right. So, please. Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is... this is why I was asking these questions. So this, I think, is an extremely ambitious goal, and... very aware, it could be completely obsolete by the time we actually get this up. So my question is, if we could do something on a 5-year time scale that could do some of this science, is that interesting? Right? Not at the 10⁻⁶ level, but maybe at a few times 10⁻⁶, where we could really measure these things.
I think both of the kind of questions one would ask are variations on delayed detonations and gravitationally confined detonations and mergers and stuff that are the active.
Although we promised to resolve them by next week. Well, don't resolve them on my account, okay? We like them being open. So this is just some of the recommendations of the study, which I won't. Well, let me go back to this plot a second. So you can see there is a. So there is this uncertainty question, which is why I raised it. Clearly, there's instruments that are, if we don't know the distance, they get ruled out pretty quickly because of their spectral resolution in terms of resolving these types of models. But if we do know the distance and we're really relying on the light curves, then the spectral resolution isn't necessarily as important. So most of our recommendations came back from these light curves and putting us in this range of the terms of technology, but detector technology. So some of the recommendations that came out were primarily for the solid state detectors with the high spectral resolution, readout electronics. So we have our final concept study online and on AstroPH. It's a pretty big file, but please check it out. And it goes under the more details on the science goals, the painful detailed performance for the instrument, as much as you could possibly want to know, probably, the mission design and our technology recommendations. One of the primary things that come out of this was, so ACT was put in this vision mission category. I don't know if you're familiar with this with NASA, which means that it was originally seen as a mission that would be so difficult to do that there would be major mission requirements that built on that. And actually, one of the primary things that came out of our study was that it was not should not have been classified as a vision mission. So all the technologies that we need to do the baseline instrument for ACT are basically in hand already. And so, in terms of the mission design, in terms of the cryogenics, the power, all that stuff, it could be done by 2015. But of course, it's really a political question. But as far as the vision missions go, we were kind of like a lame vision mission because we didn't come back with any mission requirements for NASA to go and develop, which is what they really wanted. So, in that terms, why ACT is not in the Beyond Einstein, I think, category is primarily because scientifically it's not as easy to put into that category. So, let's see, collaborators, let's see if you're interested. Now, okay, so let me switch topics a little bit, not too much, and talk about what we're doing in Berkeley. So we're basically building a very small version of this and putting on a balloon payload. This is called the Nuclear Compton Telescope, and this is my collaboration. And so this is delving a little bit more into the detector technologies. So germanium was one of the primary recommendations from the concept study, and the reason is because it has very good spectral resolution, so we can get down to 0.2% resolution or so. And so this instrument we're building is just a very small array, so it's got 12 of these detectors, and each one is about 8 centimeters on a side and about 1.5 millimeters thick, and we're putting them in this array and just basically trying to do what I said at the beginning. We're just trying to build as homogeneous a volume as we can to measure these photons as they scatter in the interaction region. And so each one of these detectors has about 81,000, well, it's got about 1 millimeter, a little bit over a millimeter cube position localization. So each one of these detectors has about 50,000 locations that it can track a photon which scatters in it and measure it with about 2 kV energy resolution. And when we put all 12 of them together, we'll have over 500,000 locations within this little volume that we can start tracking the photons as they scatter. This is just a picture. This is our prototype flight. So with the full array, which we're hoping to fly next year, is an array of 12 of these detectors. We did a prototype flight last year where we just flew two of them in our cryostat. So this is a cryostat. These have to be cooled to liquid nitrogen temperatures. There's a shield around here, but the photons are primarily coming in from the top region here. Our primary goal for this flight was to measure our background so we could justify going on to the full flight, which we did okay. Here's a press photo for our balloon on its launch vehicle. Here's just some examples of the instrument test. This is a Cobalt 60 sourced in the lab. It's got two lines at 1173 and 1333 kV. You can see the nice resolution we're getting out of these. These are actually from protons which have scattered throughout the detector, so it's not just single point locations. Here's an image of this source in our lab. So this is a highly processed image. If I didn't show it processed, you would be appalled. But spectroscopy, remember, we're doing spectroscopy, not imaging. This is the image that I wanted to point out. It's 60 degrees off axis, showing a very wide field of view we have for this technique. Basically, when the photons come in, we don't really care what angle they came from. So as long as we've got a solid volume, we can image them all over the place. So this is just our background that we measured at flight. This is, the green here, that ugly green that my grad student picked, is the measured background. This is our predicted background going in. It's probably the only instance I know of gamma ray astronomy where the background was lower than our predicted value going in, and that's because we were being very conservative on our predictions. So the biggest question was, what is the background coming in, the diffuse background at the balloon altitudes? And there's just discrepancies from the historic measurements. So we probably have a best measurement of that. But there was a range of where we expected our background to be based on those two, and this is where we showed up. So this is conservative and optimistic, and we showed up right about in the middle of it. So it was only a few hours, so it was about 5 hours. So.
Did you get a gamma ray burst?
No gamma ray burst, so I wish. And unfortunately, we were hoping to look at the crab, but our pointing system failed. So, well, okay, there's the crab shining like that projector. As far as we can tell, we were going like, whoop, 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 whoa. So we know where we were pointing, we just we couldn't control it. So I'm not completely pessimistic that we won't get anything out of it, but that was the primary goal for the prototype flight, was to test the background and to qualify us for a long-duration flight doing next year. So we've been funded and we're moving forward on this. We're going to have a full flight in December of next year, 2008. So this is the full 12 detectors, and we're flying from Australia, and we're actually doing a long-duration flight, hopefully from Australia. Our backup is Antarctica, which I don't want to go to again. Australia sounds cooler. The concept part of this is, with the 12 detectors for NCT, we should be treating these effective areas that are very comparable to Comptel, but we have less than 1% of the detector volume in Comptel. And so this is a demonstration of how we're going to achieve this very high efficiency. And combine that with our background rejection, we actually will be fairly sensitive for such a small instrument on a balloon. So this is these are predictions of sensitivities. You know, we're not knocking it out of the ballpark, but that wasn't the point of this, you know, small instrument. We're just trying to demonstrate sensitivity. So here's integral and Comptel, and these are our range depending on whether you believed our pessimistic or optimistic sensitivity calculation. So we're falling down here in the you know, less than 2 times 10 to the minus 5.
For any random point on the sky, or is that line
sensitivity? No, this is in our field of view. So this is just in our field of view.
But within the field of view, that's the line sensitivity?
That's right. That's right. And this is narrow line sensitivity. And so
where do you look at?
So galactic center, it's a source. I don't think so. If we had a chance. No, we couldn't. I don't think so, unless it's just a factor of 10 above what you would predict. So, yeah, so not high enough to I think, to drive us on the balloon flight to focus on it. So
that would be really
interesting. Absolutely. Yeah, we know it's there. We know what level it is, so kind of. So on the balloon flight, I don't think we would get it. So if... go back to this line. If we did a small instrument in space, then yeah, we could probably get 87A, which would be very interesting. So I come back to this, which we're discussing a little bit, and I just I want to get your feedback on this. So, because we could conceive of building not ACT, which is a meter on a side, but a much smaller instrument, using technologies we've already developed, and really starting to address some of these questions. But we're not going to do this 7 times 10 to the minus 7 sensitivity to distinguish W7 and DD202C. But if there are more immediate questions that we can answer, then we could conceivably do a small field of view instrument and really knock down the sensitivities by factors of 10 to 20 above what's been done before. And so these are some of the questions I'm working on. I should add another question on this is, well, so I asked, is M56 interesting on its own, measuring that mass? And to what level would it be scientifically interesting? And maybe there's a more fundamental question I should be asking on this. So that's the feedback I want to be getting on this. And so this is my little mini 1 week sabbatical. So I put these things here. What could we achieve on a small narrow field of view instrument? I want to put together sort of like a two-year catalog of supernovas and distances, and just have like a little template of these are all the supernovas. This is what their range of fluxes would be, and where would we be in terms of distinguishing them on a small mission. So I just want to use the. Somebody can help me pick out some of this data. Huh? Yeah. With the distances. So it's really a distance question, I think, that I'm asking. And the distance question here. So. But I'm going to be bugging you guys. But please, I absolutely appreciate any feedback in terms of what are the scientific questions we should be asking here, because us experimentalists, we can easily get ourselves into a corner. And in this case, I think with ACT, I think your criticisms are absolutely right. We put ourselves in a corner that on a time scale it can be done. There's a really big question of whether it would be scientifically interesting or not. I mean, I know if we did ACT in 5-year time scale, then that would be great, right? So on the 20-year time scale, is that still going to be interesting? I don't know. So.
I think if you could get your sensitivity low enough that you can detect things like nickel 57 and iron 60 and get masses for those, then you'd have a measure of the degree of neutronization in the star, which would also be different for different explosion models.
Okay. So the 60 is really hard, right? That's very low compared to the other ones. I think the nickel 57 is certainly in the right range, at least for ones that are less than 20 megaparsecs away. So, but my guess is that 60 is really difficult for us to achieve. So, we do have one of our goals for ACT in the wider context is to study the iron 60 on the galactic scale, but not on the individual supernova scale. So, we'd love to do that, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure my children will be able to do that.
So. All right. Well, Steve is sitting, I think, in Rosanne's office, and otherwise he'll seek you out.
Absolutely. Thanks.